the Bush administration looks, on first and even second glance, to be a very macho thing. It's you see Bush's Texas, his swagger, and Rummy's tough wrestler personality, and Cheney's sadistic, cruel sneer. So what about this, the role of masculinity in the Bush administration? Do you think it's an important part of their politics?
Well, I think it's an important part of virtually every American presidential politics. I don't think they have a corner on the market, but I do think it's quite particular in the current Bush administration. And in fact, my sense is that they compare themselves in their sort of manliness to not just the Clinton administration right before them, but I think there's a lot of comparison going on in their own minds with what they imagine was not the sufficient manliness, that's all in quotes, of George Bush Sr. I think there are varieties of masculinities within the Bush administration, and I think they are set up as in a contested kind of way with each other. So I don't think Rumsfeld's construction of masculinity, which may come pretty close to Cheney's, but their combined masculinities don't seem to me the same as George W. Bush's. They may be complementary, they may be useful to each other, but I don't think they're the same.
Well, how are they different?
My sense is that George W. Bush has a kind of hail fellow well-met comfort zone that is about, that's all that jokiness. And, you know, that's not automatically something that is appalling, but it can be when it's about serious topics. But it seems to, in fact, be very much part of his way of being manly in both public and private relationships. I think Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of the Treasury, who's, of course, written his own book, was really, I think, quite put off by that. And so it doesn't work in all efforts to bond around maleness. I think there's also, of course, now the kind of evangelical manliness, that kind of somebody of moral resolution, which isn't the same as being of analytical resolution, which seems very important to George W. Bush's own sense of his manly self-image. And he seems to really like and feel comfortable in the company of women, at least certain kinds of women. And not necessarily unintelligent women, but there seems to be a comfort there. Whereas Rumsfeld and Cheney, and again, I don't want to be trivial about this. I actually do think it's quite serious. Rumsfeld and Cheney seem to have adopted a kind of masculine identity and a kind of masculine way of negotiating with each other that is very much more about saying little, being not jokey, but rather very combative, assuming that you can wield silence as much as you can wield camaraderie. So they may be useful to each other, but I don't think they're quite the same. And I think in any organization, whether it be a hospital or a university or even a radio station, one would probably find varieties of masculinity being wielded, and sometimes they complement each other and work for the whole hierarchy's operation, and sometimes they don't. I think both George W. Bush and the Cheney Rumsfeld, they both find it useful to try and feminize Colin Powell, which is pretty hard to do with somebody who has been a general in the U.S. Military. But they can do it, I think, because of the long history of trying to feminize the State Department, which I think is a kind of regular theme for the last 20 years or more in American inner circles.
One of the things I think we might call feminize the State Department is that they try to be analytical, reflective, and not motivated by determination and action. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, I think that, again, feminization is something that people wield. And, yes, I think from what I can gather, and again, I think Bob Woodward's book is very helpful here. I didn't look for anything. It was about page 50, I thought, oh my gosh, there's something really going on here as to what they consider the opposite. They, and I'm talking about they, I don't really know where Condoleezza Rice is in all of this. That's interesting. We can come back to that. She's not unimportant here. But particularly listening to how Bush talks, how Rumsfeld and how Cheney, the three of them especially, it feels to me as if their notion of unmanliness is anything that is tolerant of messiness, anything that is accepting of, tolerant of, willing to engage in what they refer to as noise. And noise seems to me what you and I and probably a lot of our listeners would think of as democracy. But their notion of resoluteness, of tough-mindedness, all these masculinized notions, seems to have to do with the opposite of what the State Department, in its own bureaucratic mission, must be engaged in and must be tolerant of, which is complex negotiation, long, ongoing debates, an acceptance of varieties of points of view. And that's what it feels to me as if Bush, Rumsfeld, and Cheney, those in particular, are very uncomfortable with and therefore seem to feminize. Now, it's very interesting. If you read O'Neill's book, and O'Neill certainly was brought into the administration, and I think he was imagined in the corporation where he headed the Aluminum Corporation that he headed, he was certainly imagined to be of that same sort of Cheney-Rumsfeld ilk, and in fact, he accepted the Treasury appointment because he thought that he and Cheney were of like minds. But what happened, according to him, is once he got in, he found the thing he valued was, in fact, open debate, facing complexity, digging into the complexity. And just before he left, he came to find Colin Powell and Whitman as well, Christy Whitman of the Environmental Protection Agency. He found those two the most compatible members of the cabinet with him. So masculinity can be quite surprising, I think, as far as its varieties and who finds themselves compatible with whom. But in the Bush administration, what gets feminized is the messiness of democracy, I think.
But also, they as you pointed out, they do define themselves against Clinton, who is seen as feminine and weak and sensual and all kinds of other bad things.
I think what about
that contrast?
Yes, I think they do. And I think, I mean, in a interesting way, it's not just about military service. And, of course, with those three, that is Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Bush, it's very hard to have military service be the defining characteristic. So I think what they do is they take on what they imagine are the attributes of a militaristic, not to be confused with having ever, you know, served in the military in a substantial way, but they take on a militaristic kind of culture of masculinity. And that's what they compare themselves with Clinton. But as I say, I think, and Maureen Dowd, the op-ed writer for the New York Times, has said several times that she thinks that this Bush administration, at the very senior levels, has as their most salient comparison with themselves, something they not only compare themselves to, but want to put a distance between themselves and. And that is the first Bush administration.
Laura Flanders has written a book about the Bush women, and other people have noted also the prominence of some powerful women in the administration. Karen Hughes goes way back with W, and the very intimate relation with Condoleezza Rice, who had that slip over the tongue a couple of weeks ago where she started referring to George Bush as her husband. So how do they figure into this?
Right, and let's add in Lynn Cheney there, too, and Laura Bush. I think Laura Flanders' book, Bush Women, is just excellent. One of the things that Laura Flanders says in her book and says when she gives public talks, and I think she's quite right, is that a lot of us, those of us who think of ourselves as having some kind of at least feminist-informed curiosity, maybe feminist-informed analytical way of trying to make sense of what goes on in Washington, that many of us have been pretty dismissive of Karen Hughes, Condoleezza Rice, Lynn Cheney, Laura Bush, that in fact we ourselves sort of pass them off much too unthinkingly as being merely Bush women, and therefore not worthy of serious thought about what their own ideas are, how they came to those ideas, what their own policy and ideological orientations are. And she, in that book, and she's critical of every one of them, but she says, let's all be seriously curious about each of them. And they're not all lookalikes. They come out of different political backgrounds, different professional backgrounds. They have different kinds of ties to Bush himself. They have different kinds of ties to different corporations. And let's take them seriously and then watch the roles that they, each of them, plays in the administration. And I found myself being really sort of taken aback at how precisely Laura Flanders had described, I think, my own dismissiveness. I'm kind of embarrassed about it, but it's good that we have her out there saying, look, you can be critical, but you better be curious. And I think that's very helpful. I think they each play a different role. It is interesting that Bush is so seemingly comfortable with Condoleezza Rice and his wife, Laura Bush, and Karen Hughes. And they each play different roles in his way of feeling comfortable in the office and trying out ideas. My sense is that none of the three of them really challenge him on things that he has seemingly become convinced of. I mean, Karen Hughes really will say, no, that media approach won't work, or we've got to pay more attention to. But my sense from, again, the Woodward book and Laura Flanders book and other reporting is that none of the three of them really seriously challenge him. It could be that Laura Bush does, but we don't know. I heard Cokie Roberts say once, not long ago on radio, just offhandedly, that from what she hears, it's a good thing that Laura Bush does voice her opinion in private on certain issues. And unfortunately, the interviewer didn't follow up and ask Cokie Roberts what exactly she meant by that.
Some people might listen to our conversation and say, yeah, this is all very interesting, but it's really all about oil, or it's really all about power. It's really all about money. How do you respond to people? I'm sure you hear that critique pretty often. So how do you respond to that?
And also, I think it myself sometimes. You know? I mean, right? One always has these, unlike George Bush, who says, I never have discussions with myself. In fact, most of us do have discussions with ourselves about, you know, is the thing that we've decided to really home in on and think about analytically, that is, to try and make sense of things, to try and explain what's happening, is the thing that we've really homed in on, is it? Are we giving it too much weight? I mean, all of us do that, and I think it's a very healthy thing to do. And if we don't do it, our friends will say, hey, you know, what about? But here's what I've learned over the years. I mean, I certainly went a long time, too long, not taking the politics of masculinity and the politics of femininity, sometimes referred to as the politics of gender, but I think that's a little too bland. I think I spent years not taking that seriously. I watched armies, and I watched rank in armies, and I watched ethnicity, and I watched ethnicity everywhere, including in oil companies and in oil exploration operations. I watched ethnicity, and I watched militaries, and I watched bureaucratic status and placement. And those are the things that I kept a really close eye on in Malaysia, in the U.S., in Canada, and the Soviet Union, and Nigeria, any place I could. And once I was nudged belatedly into really taking a lot more seriously the politics of masculinity and the politics of femininity, I found not that I no longer paid attention to ethnicity, not that I no longer paid attention to financial interests, not that I no longer paid attention to aspirations of power, but rather all of those and each of them in very specific ways, in very specific contexts, in fact, are infused with negotiations over contests between and attempts to manipulate ideas about masculinity and ideas about femininity. So I don't do the either-or. I get very nervous when somebody thinks that they can talk about oil politics, either in the United States or internationally, and not talk about masculinity. I think that oil politics...
As they say in the business, is all about punching holes in the ground, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. But even that kind of shorthand, you know, completely underestimates why oil workers are amongst the most effectively unionized and carry a lot of political weight in a number of countries. You can't make sense of, for instance, Mexican oil politics unless you talk about the oil workers union. And the oil workers union is powerful in part because it is such a masculinized actor in Mexican politics. But I think the same thing is true at the level of whether it be Texas politics or Alaskan politics, is the association of the oil industry with a certain kind of legitimated, not just traditional, but seemingly very modern masculinity is one of the things that makes oil politics, not just the money, money matters, but makes it so politically potent. It is really different than being associated with the textile industry. It is really different than making a lot of money, off of the industrial cleaning industry. So I don't want to dismiss the money, and I don't want to dismiss the territory. I don't want to dismiss the corporate organizational factors going on here. But take away masculinity, and I actually don't think we can make full sense of oil politics, large or small.
Then let's turn to the big topic of the moment, of course, the torture, the images of torture, in which women figure very prominently. This has been a field day for people on the right who say, you know, like Ann Coulter, I think, says this is definitive proof we shouldn't have women in the military. Other people are saying, some people are actually confessing a bit of brokenheartedness over seeing women involved in such cruelty because, you know, they're essentially good and pure and something terrible has happened. So how do you sort all that out?
Well, I think there's several things. I mean, one is should be brokenhearted over anybody using torturous behavior against any other human being. That should be the thing that breaks one's heart collectively and personally. But I think that we know that women, in fact, are complicated people, just as men are, and they, if they are put in a positions where they are isolated, where they're dependent on fitting into a highly masculinized organization, and I don't just mean the military, I mean a particular prison hierarchy, that, and if there are people up above who want to make use of femininity as a way to not just humiliate, but to torture a male prisoner, in fact, women will be there and will be used. The people who've taught us about how femininity and masculinity are both wielded and used in torture, of course, are particularly Latin American feminists. My colleague and somebody I have learned from and admired is Ximena Bunster, who is a Chilean feminist anthropologist, and she's written one of the few books that we have on the ways in which the minute ways in which femininity and masculinity were wielded by the Pinochet torturers. But we also have studies out of Israel and from human rights groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty. This is not new to wield femininity in the name of a masculinized, controlled, and male-led torture system. We know a lot about this. Yes, it is shocking. Yes, I have absolutely been horrified to see both men and women in Abu Ghraib, American men and women, being used as operators of torture. But when I look at, and probably all your listeners as well, can now conjure up in a second the horrifying photograph of the Iraqi men who've been imprisoned and being stripped naked and made to pile on top of each other in that cell block, and then the picture of Lindy England seemingly grinning. We're not sure, we think at the camera, we're not sure what is motivating her here. And then Charles Grainer, who is the man standing behind with his arms crossed and wearing blue gloves, and he also, of course, is smiling. I look at that whole picture, and I really try to understand not just Lindy England. I want to understand what Grainer is thinking, because Grainer there is the corporal. He is a superior of England. So when you look at that photograph, look at England, and that's her superior NCO standing behind her, and he is also the one who has made her pregnant. So that's a very complicated picture there, as well as who is behind the camera and who posed, since it's a posed picture, who posed the whole thing for what objective, imagining what about Iraqi masculinities.
Seymour Hersh says in his latest piece that one theory is that the photographs were taken so that they could blackmail the guys who were photographed into becoming informants, because if the images of them engaging in homoerotic behavior were circulated, that would ruin them. So this was a point of blackmail.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things we're beginning to learn is that photographs seem to be widely used in both CIA and military intelligence operations, not only in Iraq, but also, we're now learning, in Afghanistan and in Guantanamo, and that the idea of photographing male prisoners, and now we're just learning about also photographing at least some of the Iraqi women prisoners, but photographing seems to be used as a means to intimidate, blackmail, humiliate, and that means somebody has brought in all the cameras, somebody's holding on to a lot of the photographs, and somebody dreamed up this as an idea that would serve, quote-unquote, intelligence purposes. But the posing, I mean, one of the things we've learned from feminist art historians and feminist historians of photography is that when you see photographs that are posed, you always ask, who did the posing? What did they imagine about femininity and masculinity, even if it's all men in the photos, or even if it's all women in the photos, what did they imagine about femininity and masculinity when they created that pose, and who's behind the camera? So I think we're just beginning to figure out, in fact, the whole gendered politics of each of those photographs.
Looking at these photographs, and in light of what you've just said, what do you make of the bad apples defense? You know, is this a couple of low-level people gone wild on their own, or do you think this was scripted by professionals who really knew what they were doing?
What we need to do is ask that question, and then ask it again, and then ask it again. We know from every assassination attempt, from every corruption behavior that's been revealed anywhere, that the favorite response to try to dampen our collective and individual curiosities is to say that is an exception. What we've all learned from Tailhook and from the Air Force Academy rape revelations and from Watergate and from My Lie, what we've learned, but we have to keep relearning, is always ask about the entire organizational decision-making process and the entire institutional culture. What is considered normal? What's considered trivial? What's considered allowable? What's considered outrageous? And those things build up over time. And so it's very hard when you have people further up an organization. In the military, people talk about it as chain of command, but you could take any organization. I think feminists have become very smart about this because they have had to learn all these skills to make sense of how sexual harassment happens in a law firm or in a automobile manufacturer or in a military. And that is, you at the top and in the middle, the directives that accumulatively make up the culture look either benign or bland or quote-unquote civilized, rational, modern, if you will, suited. Whereas the further down the hierarchy, the actions taken to carry out those oblique or direct instructions from above look cruder, look more obvious, look more blatant. So it doesn't mean that the people the men and women, that is both Charles Grainer and Lindy in England and their compatriots in the military police unit, the reservist unit. Doesn't mean they shouldn't be held accountable. They absolutely should be held accountable. But that's the beginning of the story, not the end of the story. And the further up the chain of command we get, and that should go right outside the uniform into people around Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld himself, and I would say right into the White House, it will be harder to be outraged because it will sound blander. Those instructions will sound less outrageous. And we've really got to learn how to be outraged at things that, at least at first hearing, sound bland.